loves.
Welcome to Talking Books. Today I have as a guest someone who isn't a stranger to Ten Radio, but who has happily agreed to come on to chat books and writing with me. Welcome medieval historian and author of both non-fiction and fiction, Catherine Hanley. Do you like to be called Catherine or Kath or...
I've got lots of names. If I use my full name, I go for Catherine Hanley, but in general conversation, just Kath on its own.
All right. Okay. Welcome, Kath. Anyway, now, the first time we met was at the Wivvy Lit Fest in September last year. It was a great event, wasn't it?
It was absolutely fantastic. A really, really good couple of days. Loads of really interesting speakers, including yourself, of course. And yeah, it was just wonderful to see that sort of thing going on in Wivvy.
Yeah, and is there going to be plans, hopefully, for some more in the future, maybe?
Yeah, all plans are subject to change, obviously, because we never know what's just around the corner. But our thinking at the moment is that we might make it into a biennial festival and alternate it with the Ten Parishes Festival. So they're in odd numbered years and we would be in even numbered years. But we're still working on that.
Still working on that. But it was wonderful and I was really pleased to be part of it. Now, I wanted you to tell us about, I mean, for a long time, you've been an academic historian and you publish books of accessible history. Now, do you want to tell us a little bit more about your background?
Yeah, I as you say, I was an academic and I published, it was 20 years ago now, actually, because it came out in 2003, a real kind of out, what you'd call a real out and out academic book about history. And I don't know, I just felt I was sort of putting on an academic voice, and then that didn't really suit me. And then, of course, there's the fact that with it being an out and out academic book, it was, you know, read by about four other people, all of whom were already specialists in the same subject. And as I sort of moved on, I just thought, this isn't, you know, I love writing, but this isn't exactly what I want to write. This isn't the style. This isn't the genre that I want to write in. So I decided to start writing for a much wider audience. It's what we call trade history or popular history. So I still make sure that what I write is based on really, you know, proper, rigorous scholarly research. I go right back to the primary sources and, you know, all that kind of thing. But I try and write it in a way that's just much more interesting. You know,
accessible.
And, no, what I write because I want everyone to love medieval history as much as I do. And the way to do that is to be enthusiastic about it and accessible about it. And what I hope in my books, and which I think I've achieved most of the books I've written, probably the one that my biography of Empress Matilda is the one that's done this the best, is that, yeah, it's based on all that scholarly research, but you can just pick it up and read it. Even if you didn't know anything about the subject beforehand, you can pick it up, you can read it either just as a really interesting story about what happened to somebody in the past, or, you know, if you're more into it, to look at it more in depth. But it's brought my passion, medieval history, to a much, much wider audience than I ever did with any of my academic writing. And that's what I'm trying to do with my nonfiction now.
I think that's key, because when I write my nonfiction, you do feel like you want to be absolutely rigorous in your research. But at the same time, if somebody is coming to your book, like mine with Keats and yours with Matilda, you want them to know that, you know, there were interesting people in the past. You know, we don't have to read popular celebrity biographies. There's some really fascinating stuff going on hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, yeah. And I think my attitude towards writing, I think one of my favourite reviews that I've ever had was not a one in a published newspaper, but one that was on Amazon or Goodreads or something. And somebody who I don't know at all, just who'd read one of my books, said, "I like Catherine Hanley's style. I feel like we're sitting down having a nice cup of tea and she's telling me a story." And I thought, that's it.
That's
that's what I'm aiming for. Yeah.
Absolutely perfect. Now, you've had a book out last year. It is last year now, 2022. It feels fresh off the press, but it is last year. Do you want to tell us about that? It's a bit more of an epic, isn't it, I think?
Yes, a bit of a whopper. It's called, I decided, because my last two books before that had both been biographies of single individuals, I thought I would go for something that was a bit of a bigger picture. And it's called Two Houses, Two Kingdoms, A History of France and England, 1100 to 1300. And, well, I mean, it kind of does what it says on the tin. It's a history of France, but it's specifically, it's about the relationship between the two ruling dynasties of England and France. And it's told through the stories of the people involved. So it's very, very people-centric. So we've got some wonderful characters in that. You know, we've got Richard the Lionheart. We've got Eleanor of Aquitaine. We've got some wonderful French kings like Philip Augustus and St. Louis. And it just fascinated me the extent to which, you know, kind of decisions that affected people nationally and internationally and affected the lives of millions of people could be taken based on, you know, whether two individuals liked each other or not. You know, because it's not a coincidence that at times when the two kings of each country were really friendly with each other, that there were extended periods of peace, and that when we happened to get two kings on the thrones who just couldn't stand the sight of each other, that the two countries were at war. You know, those things are not unrelated.
Yeah, and I always think that it's really fascinating to read about medieval history. And then to think about how much we take for granted today, you know, the sending out of heralds, and how long it would take for a message to get from A to B, and some calamity could have taken place in the intervening period.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's just to go back to Empress Matilda for a minute, that's exactly how she got usurped. She was the heir to the throne, but when her father died, she was usurped by her cousin Stephen, who made it all the way over from France to England, secured the royal treasury, rode to London, got himself crowned king, and that had all happened before Matilda even knew that her father was dead. Because it took 3 weeks for the message to reach where she was.
Yeah, we have to. That's what makes it so interesting, I think. You sort of have to completely reframe, because even if we watch it on a television, you know, on a film or on a documentary, there's still no real sense of the distance and length of time people had to cover.
Yeah, and actually these practicalities are something that really interests me, not just, you know, how long did it take to get a message from A to B, but, you know, not just thinking about the great sweep of kings and politics and wars and battles, but all those, you think, you know, what did their clothes look like? What are they eating for dinner? You know,
the social
that kind
history.
Of thing.
Yeah. Now, I was going to ask you about that particularly because I know that you've done some work with reenactment and working with a dark age village and in an educational way. What's so important about that, do you think, especially working with children? I think
it gives you a much better idea. So I should say some academic historians are a bit sniffy about reenactment, but I'm certainly not one of them. You know, if it's, you know, people think it's people running around with foam swords shouting "prithee" and "forsooth." And
I know
like
somebody
really,
who's I know somebody whose cheekbone and face was slashed right open during a battle reenactment.
That's taking realism a little bit too far, possibly. And it's not all about battles. You know, reenactors also do this thing called living history, and this is what I did when I worked at what is now called Danelaw Viking Village in York, where we had groups of children coming in. And it was great because you're teaching them about everyday life. If I lived in the Middle Ages, I wouldn't be a king or a queen making the big political decisions. I would be somebody living in a small village with my family, trying to keep everything going, trying to keep everybody fed and clothed and, you know, working and talking to my neighbours. And I just think it's really, really interesting to delve into that kind of thing. And what we used to find with it was primary school age children that came to the Viking village. And it varied very much according to the time of year. The ones who came in the summer, when it was lovely and sunny and they were sort of, you know, making some, doing some pottery or something, and the weather was lovely. Oh, this is quite nice. And the ones that came in the winter, you know, when it's knee deep mud and it's freezing and we sent them out in their wellies to go and plough a field or something, we're all sitting there going, well, it's not much fun being a Viking, is it? And we're like, no, you get
it's not
it
all
now.
Rape and pillage.
And that practical experience, I find, really helps. Okay, I mean, not perhaps not so much with my non-fiction, but with my fiction, which does feature what we might call, you know, ordinary people rather than kings and queens. Just that background, you know, what you can picture it. I can picture, because I know I've done that research into that real everyday life. If I talk about my characters in their little village cottage, you know, I know what it looks like and I know what's cooking on the fire and I know what they're wearing and how they're going to sweep up afterwards and that kind of thing. And it just brings you much closer. And it doesn't have to be medieval. That might be anything. It might be, you know, you might be interested in researching your Victorian ancestors or something.
Yes. And the interesting thing is also, I mean, I'm completely ignorant of how names worked in medieval times, things like surnames, but so many of our names come from the jobs that people did, didn't they? And I know that my father, my maiden name is Furneau, which is French, and he had this glamorous idea we'd come over in the French Revolution, you know, imagining we were some aristocracy. But Furneau, it turns out, means kitchen stoves. So it's very unlikely. It's very unlikely that we were above stairs. We were much more likely to be below stairs. So, yes. You know, you can learn an awful lot, can't you, about jobs and where people lived and all sorts of things from the surnames. And a lot of that came from your period, didn't it?
Yes, yeah, it was just at the time where people were starting. So just to specify, I'm talking about sort of the 12th and 13th centuries here. So it's what I would call the central Middle Ages. So we're post the Norman conquest, but we're not right up to, you know, kind of Tudors or anything like that yet. And yeah, this was just the period when people started using surnames. So the aristocracy were using, you find, hereditary surnames, but people lower down the social scale, they just didn't really need them. And they only really needed them if, you know, if there were two people with the same name, because obviously lots and lots of men are called John and William.
Yes.
And all the women are called Isabel and Alice. So you need something. And it is interesting how it went. If you travelled somewhere else, so for example, you wouldn't be called Catherine of Wiveliscombe if you never left Wiveliscombe, because there would be no need to call you of Wiveliscombe, because that's where you are. But if you travelled somewhere else and there was somebody else called Catherine there, or John or William or whatever, then you might be called of Wiveliscombe because you'd come from somewhere different. Whereas if you stayed in the place where you were born, you might be more likely, I mean, they come in groups. They're either, this is what we call patronymics, which is where everything that ends in son, you know, Robinson, yes, Peterson, things like that. Or they're based on jobs. My name's Hanley, which is Irish, but my maternal line's name is Weaver, which is, you know, about as obvious as you can get.
Yes, no guesses there.
Or you might get ones that are based on personal appearance. So things like, you know, black, white, brown colours, their hair colours normally. Or they might be where you live in the village. Because somebody said, I actually had this conversation the other day. Somebody said, well, yeah, okay, brown, white, black hair colours. Why are so many people called green? and that's actually not a hair colour. That's because you lived by the village green. So you might have, if you had two Johns in a village, you might have, you know, John who lives by the green and John who lives in, you know, by the well, or you know, tall John and short John or something. And then at the time, they were just individual, so they were just for individuals, and it was just at this time when they just started to become hereditary. So you'd get somebody who's called, you know, Jack Johnson, but then his children will start to be called Johnson and Johnson rather than changing it every generation. So it's a really interesting period to study.
Now, I am a nonfiction writer who is now dabbling in their first fiction, I'm particularly interested to know how you approach writing your fiction. Do you use it as a kind of a light relief, or is it just another way to bring the fascinating history to a different audience, or is it a combination of the two?
Oh, it's a bit of everything. When I'm writing fiction, I think that I like non-fiction best. And when I write non-fiction, I can't wait to put it down and go and write some fiction.
Fiction is really hard work.
It is. Okay, so partly I started this fiction series. It's a series of medieval murder mysteries to fill in a gap, actually, because I knew that a certain Earl was on one, I knew for a fact because from the records that he was on one side of a war on one date, right. And then a date a few months later he was on the other side of the war, and then later on still he went back to the first side again. Now I know that because it's in the records of, you know, which charters he witnessed and all that sort of thing. What I had no idea about was why or how. And of course, if you're writing non-fiction history, all you can do is say this happened.
Yeah.
We're not sure why, you know, we might speculate a little bit, but you know, you write a fictional story, you just make it up.
Yes.
So, but the way I approached that was that real people are only ever background characters in my novel. The principal protagonists are always fictional. Because I can sort of do what I like with them.
Yeah.
And putting a fictional character in against a factual backdrop, I just find is a really, really good way to explore what's going on. And also, I wanted to do something a bit different. You know, so much of history is about the rich people, the, you know, the earls, the barons. And actually, quite a lot of historical fiction is as well. Quite a lot of historical fiction is about, you know, the queens and the, you know, and you tend to read things like, he passed his cloak to the squire, or, you know, she had her maid fix her hair. And I used to think to myself, well, what's it like to be that squire?
Yes.
Or that maid. So all the people in my fiction books who have a voice, the ones from, you know, with the narrative point of view, they're all ordinary people. They're not, they're all the earls, kings, dukes, everything. They're all just relegated to the background. And it's the normal people who have the voice. And I just wanted to do it that way around. And that's where all this, you know, research about normal life came in, because it's quite nice to just have my characters in a village rather than a castle.
Yes. But when you think about it, I mean, these are medieval mysteries, aren't they? And there's a wonderful sort of like a... authors tap into that in a way that really suits the mystery genre. I think there is something because we feel we know less than maybe we should, or the backdrop is really quite exciting, that then it makes a really good period to set a mystery in. Did you find that there was a lot of
it seems to draw a lot of historical fiction these days is historical crime. Historical crime is very much the genre in its own right. And I wonder if that is because, you know, as historians, so much of the past is a mystery. You know, and I mean, of course, in the 13th century, there are an awful lot of wars and murders and things going on as well. You know, I wouldn't be able to write a modern detective novel. I mean, I've got absolutely no idea how the police force works, or
police
forensics
procedural.
Or anything like police procedural and forensic science and all that sort of thing. But you know, put me in 1217 and I'm fine. And it is just a way of bringing the past. So some people who read my books do it because they like to solve the puzzle, they like to solve the mystery and work out who done it. But other people have said to me, you know, they're actually not terribly interested in the mystery part of it. They read it to find out what life was like for people in the 13th century, and because they like the characters. So it's interesting just to try and put all that together.
Yes, and I think you can call it a mystery. And I think, you know, sort of like the legacy of Agatha Christie. Now we're moving far more into police procedurals, I think. You know, there is this shock horror element things that are coming in, rather than a mysterious element that may be based on something, because yours is a fascinating period for things like medicine, isn't it? So if someone got an arrow somewhere painful, you know, it wasn't necessarily that easy to survive.
The manuscript of book 8 in the series, which I have just delivered this week to the publisher and will be out in October, actually does no spoilers, but it does contain something of a medical nature, such as you've just mentioned, that I had to do some quite gory research.
It is gory, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, it was gory up to the 19th century when I was writing about medicine, so it didn't really get any better.
There's one a few books back in the series where I had to get quite heavily into medieval dentistry, and I tell you, that's not for the faint-hearted. I love to write about the 13th century. I really, really wouldn't want to live there.
No, that's true. No, that would have been a good question. How would you feel about living in the 13th century, Catherine?
Well, I mean, I'd be dead by now. You know, childhood illnesses, you know, no NHS or anything like that, or no medical knowledge. You know, I'm certainly one of the people who would be a statistic by now. Yeah.
Or I might be some very aged crone. On the edge of, I mean, at my age, definitely aged crone, I think. It really was a time when, you know, you died young, didn't you? So
well, actually, that's one of the myths I like to bust. There's this persistent myth that you were considered really, really elderly, you know, by the time you were about sort of 35 or 40, because the average age of death was so young. But the thing is, that average age of death takes into account the horrendous levels of infant mortality.
So if you
take out, you know, all the babies and the small children who died of what would be preventable illnesses now, if you took out all of those, and if you only look at people who lived long enough to be adults in the first place, we find that they are living into their 50s, 60s, 70s. Indeed, there were several popes who were over 80 before they were even elected in the Middle Ages. And Eleanor of Aquitaine lived to be in her 80s. So, yeah, if you reached 20, you were pretty likely to reach 40.
If
you reached 40, you'd be a reasonable bet to head towards 60. You'd be a bit more, you know, kind of worn out.
Yes. Toothless, essentially.
well, again, not so much because they didn't eat any sugar.
Ah, no, of course. See, this is fascinating. I knew we'd be able to talk fascinating stuff, but we have
already think you were going to be talking about teeth and dentistry, did you, when you started this call?
I did say, this is funny, because I said this to Catherine before we started, that it was interesting. Social history is fascinating. When I was writing my book about Keats, I knew it wasn't going to be a very academic tone, but it was amazing how interested people were in his teeth or his shoes. So actually we didn't realize that these things were so important, but actually they are the most fascinating fun bits, really.
Aren't they? And if you're going to then go and write fiction, that's exactly the sort of thing that you want to have, you know, in the background. You don't need to make a big thing about it. You don't need to write a whole passage that says, and his shoes look like this, but it's the sort of thing that you need to have as the sort of background, because for the people you're writing about, that was the background to your life. And actually, that is one of the things that's most difficult about writing fiction, actually, is to try and describe or write about something that was completely familiar to people in the period you're writing about, but is not familiar to people now, because the danger is that you end up just giving this massive explanation that is just you talking to your reader, and it takes you away from your characters. So you know, if I name, you know, if I've got my squire in my books, you know, helping his lord put his armour on, he knows all the names for the different bits of armour. He doesn't need to have it explained to himself. And then he put on the leg armour, which was called.
I know.
Because it takes you right out of it. But you've got to get it across that it was familiar to them, but without confusing your audience, who's just sitting there going, what?
I know. Haven't we all read books where suddenly there's three pages of exposition on something we really didn't need to know? It just slows the plot down.
Yeah, we call that the as you know Bob. It's where two characters who know something completely just stand there. Well, as you know, Bob, the armor that does this is called that. Or it happens in everything. It's sci-fi. As you know, Bob, the engine works via a quantum. And it's like two characters who already know something are explaining it to each other, only for the benefit of the reader. And that's what really brings you out. You know, what you want to do if you're writing about the past is to immerse your reader in it. The best compliment that a writer of historical fiction can get is somebody going, I really felt like I was there. And if you start doing all these sort of modern explanations or giving your characters really modern views, you know, that's my other sort of bugbear. You end up with not credible historical people. What you've got is modern people.
With
funny clothes.
Yes.
You know, if you put people with very modern ideas and drop them into the 12th century, they sound like modern people in the 12th century. They don't sound like 12th century people.
It's really hard work. I think fiction is very hard work. People, you know, you can underestimate historical fiction, the amount of work that has to go in it. Now, we have been talking for a jolly long time and we've got to stop, sadly. But I could go on for hours talking to you about this. I knew it would be like that.
I'm sure everybody's thrilled to hear about medieval dentistry.
Medieval dentistry, boots and shoes, definitely. Now, tell us how we can find out more about you, where we can find you on Tintinet.
Okay, I have a website, the URL of which is katherinehanley, all in one word, .co.uk. And you can find out more about my books there and things I've written, things I'm working on at the moment. I don't use very much social media. I'm not on Facebook or Instagram, but I do use Twitter for those of you who use it. And my username on there is @KathHanley, all in one word. That's about it, really. I don't have a big online presence. You know, you generally find me hanging around in Wivy Library, actually, rather
best
than
place to be.
Online.
Best place. Oh God, I miss going to the library. It's lovely in France, but I miss going to the library. Well, I can go to one. I just can't read any of the books properly. So thank you very much, Kath, for coming on. That's fascinating. And we could talk for ages, loads of other things to talk about. So you'll have to come on again when your next book comes out later this year.
Okay, thank you very much for having me.
Our aspirations wrapped up in books, our inclination.